Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writingexcuses.
Hey, listeners. We want your input on season 20, which, I have to be honest, does not sound like a real number. What elements of the craft do you want us to talk about? What episode or core concept do you use or reference or recommend the most? Or what are you just having trouble with? After 20 seasons, we've talked about a lot of things. What element of writing do you wish we'd revisit for a deeper dive on the podcast? Email your ideas to podcast@writingexcuses.com.
Season 19, Episode 14. This is Writing Excuses.
A close reading on voice, epistolary storytelling through voice.
15 minutes long.
Because you're in a hurry.
And we're not that smart.
I'm Mary Robinette.
I'm Dong Wan.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Howard.
And at the very beginning of our journey in this book, I talked about how much I loved the fact that it used epistolary, said it uses letters. And so we're going to really dive into how voice is working within the epistolaries in this particular episode. And I actually want to start before we get into a specific reading that I'm going to ask Dong Wan to do just to hear them do it, is that I'm wondering sort of what is it, why do we use epistolaries? Like, what is it that letters actually do in voice? I'll say for me, one of the things I like about using letters is that there are two sort of things going on at the same time. There's what you plan to say, and the fact that you know you're writing it to a specific audience, that your character is writing it to someone, and so they expect it to be read, and that changes the way that they actually present themselves and the things that they put on the page. Agree?
I do agree, because I think that one of the things that that illuminates is very clearly what the character thinks of the other character, because of the way they frame things, the all of the subtext that goes into that epistolary letter. And it is also, I think, one of the things that is fun, because there is the epistolary that is the letter, and then there's also things that are like news articles, and those are very different because they're written to a broad audience, whereas a letter is written, as you say, to one specific person, and that is, I think, that's fun.
Mm-hmm. The letter epistolary, the thing I love really about it is I'm such a sucker for the second person in a piece of fiction. I love the you address. It plays with your subjectivity as the reader in such an interesting way, because it forces you into the position of the person on the other end of this, right? And so in this case, switching between red and blue and using the second person, I'm put in a position where I have to identify with the person receiving the letter in a way that I think is really fascinating with me, and I think really deepens the connection to character in this book. It's a really clever trick that I really love.
How do I know what I think until I see what I say? I have operated on that principle for decades now. And as a writer, writing an epistolary section is much like writing a monologue. You get far deeper into the character's brain by writing that than you would by trying to write dialogue. Because dialogue, you keep switching out of their head and into someone else's, whereas the epistolary, halfway through that letter, if you're doing it well, if you're doing it the way I do it anyway, you are not you anymore. You are this other person, and it's just magical and fun. And the word that I guess I would use is luxurious.
Mm-hmm.
And
luxury.
As writers, we don't always get the luxury. The editors tell us, pare that back a little, please.
Well, that's what I was about to say is, as a reader, I very much enjoy this. As a publisher, I get very nervous, right? So when these two authors pitched me, they're like, hey, we're co-writing a book that's time travel and epistolary. And I was like, oh, those are three things that really struggle in the market, you know? And so my initial reaction was like, are we sure this is a good idea, guys? But it ended up working out really well. But the thing is, just to remember, as with something this voicey, as we're kind of talking about in general, these are tools to be used sparingly and very deliberately. This is a book that's full of them. I don't recommend anybody do this in the future, but it can work, right? You can get away with it if you, you know, do it in certain ways and are really effective at reaching that audience. But epistolary can be a little distancing for the reader.
Well, and one of the reasons that it works here is that the letters themselves are part of the plot.
Yes.
And so the letters have intention. And if you knew that they were receiving letters, but you didn't get to read them, you would be frustrated as a reader. So they're serving multiple functions. There's multiple reasons why we're seeing the letters. And one of the mistakes that I'll see an early writer make is that they'll put in a letter because they've seen it in somebody else's thing and they thought it was cool, but they don't understand why it's being used. Mm-hmm. And so they apply it to a situation that's where it's not appropriate. And also that there's no movement inside the letter. Yeah. There's nothing that's unpacking. Like one of the things that I love in these is that we've got Blue's first letter, you know, look upon my works, ye mighty in despair. And then when Red responds to that, the close of that is, my regards to the vast and trunkless legs of stone, which is this playfulness. There is this, you get this back and forth, even though they are not in exchanging lines of dialogue, mm-hmm. you still get the sense of it being a conversation.
Well, and then there's a reversal because so often when I run across a letter section in a book, it's very dry compared to the narrative around mm-hmm. it. It's very much like this is a formal missive or I'm writing something in this elevated way. And I'm always like, I feel like I want to skim over it versus this, which is these letters are so funny. So much of the spark and the wit and the ease of the book is found in the letters. And then the narration in between is very dense and chewy. But then we get to the letter and it's almost like a breath of fresh air because of these allusions, because of these jokes. And I love how pop culture-y the letters are. They'll reference stuff, you know, quote songs, quote things like that. You know, I think that's infected my language is I now say, as the prophets say, after I quote a line from a song or something like that, which is very corny, well, but like, it's fun.
Some of the song quotations are subtle and you know, some much less subtle, you know, referring to Blue as, you know, Blue Dabadee.
Yeah.
And now you're humming that one song. Yeah. But also there was a point just in the middle of a paragraph where someone says, harder, better, faster, stronger, which is a whole Daft Punk song.
Yeah.
And yeah, the letters are just rife with those pop culture citations embedded in a way that if you don't know that it's mm-hmm. a citation, it's just a turn of phrase.
Well, and some of them thread through in plot relevant ways, right? So we start with the Shelley quote, and that comes back again very late in the book. That in a way that is very emotionally resonant, like and these echoes that they can layer in of these references and these allusions that don't feel high-minded. I mean, they're quoting, you know, a very famous poem from what, the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you don't know the reference, you still get the vibe of what's happening here, right? They're load-bearing in certain ways, but not in a way that's exclusionary, and that's part of what makes it so fun reading these letters.
Speaking of fun, reading the letters, the time has come to
Are you really going to make me read this?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so, you know, one example of the way humor works in this and why I find these so delightful is the letters can be quite silly, you know, in a way that's really good. So, anyways, Aaron is torturing me by making me read this. My perfect red. How many boards would the Mongols hoard if the Mongol horde got bored? Perhaps you'll tell me once you're finished with this strand. Just like these little references and jokes layered throughout, it is so delightful to me. And then, you know, there's a later line in the same letter that's this taunting voice, right? A suggestion of corruption in my command chain, a charming concern for my well-being. Are you trying to recruit me, dear Cochineal? And then we'd be at each other's throats even more. Oh, Petal, you say that like that's a bad thing. Like, there's so much dialogue here. There's so much voiciness here. The characters are coming through in such this crisp, playful way as, like, Blue taunts Red through this whole letter. And, you know, we're going to see such, like, a different you know, evolution in the tone of their letters to each other as we go. But these early ones are such a hook for the audience.
Yeah, and I think I've been thinking since we talked about it a few episodes ago why I find these to be so dense in some ways. And I think it's because I'm responding to the denseness of personal indulgence as opposed to the denseness of poetic prose.
Ooh, I love that.
Do you know what I mean? So because these are the moments in which I feel like I get the best sense of who they are because of the way that they're trying to present themselves, as opposed to, which is like the splash of color against this beautiful backdrop of poetry, which I absolutely love.
Indulgence is definitely the right word there.
Yeah.
The luxuriating and indulgent that I can feel in reading these how much Max and Amal just love to write.
Oh, yeah. And love to write to each other, right? These letters, they wrote these this novella sitting literally back-to-back, passing a laptop back and forth. So one would write the letter and hand it to the other. And that I think that's where that sense of playfulness come from. You can feel the friendship in this. You can feel the taunting, you know, back and forth as they're both trying to show off for each other in a way that I think comes through.
Oh, you're going to go Blue Dubba D? Yeah. Well, I got some Daft Punk on tap for you, baby.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, hey, I've got some fun questions about how these epistolaries, not just how they work, but how we can do the same sorts of things, maybe even do the same sorts of things without being epistolary. But I think those questions have to wait until after the break.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Making your mental health a priority is always a challenge. And I think it's easy to not prioritize it, especially when you're trying to figure out how to write a book. I think we have some deep cultural idea that artists should be tortured and depressed to make their best work. But in my experience, struggling to find clarity and motivation will hurt your process a lot more than help it. In my own life, therapy has been essential to figuring out how to navigate an industry seemingly designed to give all of us anxiety. Being able to talk to an expert can help you set better boundaries, find a balance between the demands of your work and your art, and navigate the complexities of being a published writer. That said, finding a therapist is never easy, especially if you're not in a major city like I am. That's where a service like BetterHelp can be of use to help you start the process while you figure out what your needs are for your mental health journey. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/WX today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/WX.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I am excited to tell you about a song this week, and it's the song Story 2 by the group Clipping. And what I love about songs just in general is that they have to put so much story into like a really small space. And in this case, it's through a character study of a guy named Mike Winfield. I won't tell you much more because it literally takes 3 minutes to actually listen to the song. But one thing that I want you to listen for maybe the second time around or as you're sort of enjoying it is how we get so much about who Mike Winfield is, where he's been, and the tension of the current moment all at once. The second thing to look for is something that Clipping does that's amazing is they change the time signature of the song as it goes and tension is heightened, which is something that you may be able to use in changing the tempo of your prose. So look at how they decide when to change that tempo and what you can learn from it by listening to Story 2 by Clipping.
Let me start with this question. The luxuriance, the indulgence, the loving to write, can we do this without resorting to epistolary? Are these tools available to us in other ways?
Yeah, absolutely. They're still using the same tools that we've been talking about for voice all along. They're still using pacing, accent, attitude, experience, focus even. But what they're doing is that in the epistolary, it gives you a little bit more freedom, just a little bit, to have some of those repetitions, some of the more colloquial language. And you can do that absolutely when you're not in epistolary form. And that's where that free indirect speech that we've been talking about comes back in, that some of the things that are very specifically their phrasing, if you took that and you shifted it to third person and you put it into the middle of a paragraph of action, just a sentence out of that, you would get that same sense of the character, but you would get it spread out through the book instead of in this compressed place of the epistolary where it's isolated in form.
I also think being playful in the middle of a serious situation is something that we can all use. I mean, you are the humor expert, so you know this sort of better than anyone. But I think that that's something to think about here, is that just because a topic is serious or a theme is serious doesn't mean that there isn't room for play. And that room gives us a breath. It's like gallows humor. Even in the worst of times, people often use humor to respond to it. There is an episode of Deep Space Nine that I love where all the people are going to die, and how they respond to it shows you so much about their character. One person gets quiet, one person jokes, one person plans. And that shows a lot in the way, and you can do that in voice. Somebody who starts making a list at the, you know, in their imminent death is coming, is going to feel different than somebody who jokes about the 8 different ways they could die.
The thing I love about the humor here, though, is when I encounter humor in fiction, sometimes it's very frustrating because it undermines the emotional beats of the overall story. Mm. Here, the humor never contradicts the story. It never contradicts the character beats. It is so clearly a character masking an emotion or taunting somebody else or being playful, but it takes the world seriously and it takes the stakes seriously and finds a way to be funny in the middle of that, right? And so I think the overall impression when people talk about Time War, when they think about this book, is of this lush romanticism, of this like deep character work and poeticness. But the experience of reading it, I often find myself laughing out loud at different beats of the book, and it's much funnier than I think people remember when they come back to it.
And as a humorist, that is what I reach for when I'm writing anything that is not... would not be categorized as humor. During a critique group for one of the shorts that I published for Space Eldritch, a friend said, the joke that you put in this scene kind of undermines a whole lot of tension and horror that's been happening. And my response was, I know, I got too tense and scared, and so I just did it. And the rest of the group was like, so did we, thank you. It's like, oh, okay, so this is, it's not to everybody's taste, but I reflexively used the tool correctly. And that's one of the things that's so cool about these kinds of tools, is that sometimes if you are getting too tense, if you are getting too emotional, you realize, I need to turn a phrase in a way that makes me giggle.
And this is also, that sense is also something that your character will be experiencing while they are writing the letter. So there is a performative aspect to an epistolary section where the character is conscious of the fact that their words are going to be judged. And so they are trying to present themselves in a certain way. When we look back at that first letter from Red, my cunning methods for spiriting her from your clutches, engine trouble, a good spring day, a suspiciously effective and cheap remote access software suite her hospital purchased 2 years ago, which allows the good doctor to work from home. And it's like, I'm just going to show off just a little bit. You think you've got me? No, no, no. Look at how clever I am. I set this up 2 years before you even got here. And that kind of performative nature, I think, and how am I going to be judged, is again a thing that you can bring outside of the epistles into the way your character is moving through the world. How are people going to judge me by the actions that I take and the words that I say? And in the text of a letter, it becomes very, very clear.
Yeah, and I think it really also is a great way to show character development, mm-hmm. because the way you move through the world changes, and therefore the type of performance you get better at performing. Maybe other people get better at judging. They become more familiar with you. And I know we wanted to look also at some of the letters from the very end, because how does the relationship change? I know, Howard, you had some thoughts about how the even the sign-off changes from the very beginning to the end of when we get the letters.
There's a technique that I need to give a name to so that I can just call it a thing, in which you define terms for your reader. And one of the terms that gets defined through these epistolaries is the sign-off yours. And this is from an epistle that Red's writing to Blue. I am yours in other ways as well. Yours as I watch the world for your signs, epiphanic as a horisfex. Yours as I debate methods, motives, chances of delivery. Yours as I review your words by their sequence, their sound, smell, taste, taking care no one memory of them becomes too worn. Yours. Still, I suspect you will appreciate the token. And then Red closes the letter. Yours, Red. And every letter afterward is closed, whether from Red or Blue, with the word yours. Now we know what that word means to them, because Blue would not write yours absentmindedly. Blue would write yours saying, yes, all of those definitions you gave me and more. And so by defining the term here, Max and Amal have lent weight to the word so that one word can do a huge lift all the way through the rest of the book.
Well, one thing I really love about this technique is it lets them be more directly emotional from the perspective of the character than you could get in narration sometimes, right? In narration, you sort of have to have a little bit of a step back, and being able to fully embody for pages at a time the deeply lovesick romantic characters that we're seeing can lead to a more direct address. In particular, there's one line that I've seen quoted many times, but I'd love to reference it here just to show how far we've gotten from the playful tone of the early letters to now in these like deep professions of love.
And as I read this to you, I want you to think about two tools that we were talking about, repetition, and then there's also resonance. And that's where you recognize that there's a link between something we've said before and something we're saying now. So this section has some lovely repetition in it. I love you. I love you. I love you. I'll write it in waves, in skies, in my heart. You'll never see, but you will know. I'll be all the poets. I'll kill them all and take each one's place in turn. And every time love's written in all the strands, it will be to you. But never again like this.
The thing I love about this passage, I mean, other than it's like heartbreakingly romantic and it's so beautifully written, but it's still so clearly identifiable as Red, that Red's most romantic gesture is, I will kill all the poets through all of time and replace them. Like, that's her solution to making sure Blue understands how much she loves her.
Yeah, and it again resonates, I think, with that first moment when we meet Red on the battlefield. And the thing about this resonance is that it's one of the ways that you can allow the reader, you can make space for the reader. And that's something that is really important in stories, I think, because the reader inhabits half of the story. Like, the writer has the thing, and then we invite the reader to it. But you bring so much of yourself to it, your own experience. And, you know, when you are imagining a voice, you are using your own experience to imagine that voice. So having those resonant moments where you can insert yourself and you can feel that, where you're drawing the connections yourself, makes it stronger than stories where everything is explained out completely. Those stories tend to get very flat.
Mm-hmm. One other thing I love about this and the mention of repetition and in that is that one of the first things we see is repetition, which we talked about in a previous episode. She has won. Yes, she has won. She is certain she has won, hasn't she? Mm-hmm. And that is, repetition can be both sure and unsure. Like, repetition is very interesting because sometimes you repeat something because you know it. And sometimes you repeat something because you wish you knew it. You want to convince yourself of it. and seeing Red move from this sort of trying to repeat the things I have been told and taught are important to something I am claiming as important for myself. It's just a great way to look at how the same tool can be used two different ways. And is also a great way to show movement in the character as a whole.
And this goes back to the previous episode, but in the way that Blue communicates confidence and vulnerability in her voice, we're seeing that come into Red now. Red is much more confident in this scene than she's ever been in the early scenes. But that confidence is coming through an incredible vulnerability, an incredible moment of stress and distress in this letter as she's communicating how much she loves Blue, but also knows that Blue is dying at her hand in these moments, right? And so the incredible complexity of what's happening here, but we're seeing a Red that is so much more certain and aware of herself and what she wants and who she is than we've seen up until this point in the book.
And she's also doing a thing in this where she is using some of the cadence of Blue with the listing. I'll write it in waves, in skies, in my heart, but doing it with the Red short punctuated sentences. So it's this thing where she is both reflecting the person that she loves and also truly expressing herself.
She's learning how to write this way, right?
The line, Red may be mad, but to die for madness is to die for something, is, I get chills.
Yeah.
The confidence, the acceptance, the decision, and I'm in the chapter where Red is at a dead run trying to fix an unfixable problem.
Well, I think on that chill, we will move to the homework for you, which is to write a short note from one of your characters to another about something that's important to them. And then you're going to make it short because you're going to have to do it a couple of times. Rewrite it as a text message. So you're going to change the format a little bit. How does that change the way that this note is happening? Then write it as something that's going to be screened. Think about the way somebody in prison might have their letter read by someone else who doesn't care about it before it gets to their intended target. So that changes a little bit of the context. And then finally, write it as the final message they will ever get to send in their life, which changes the stakes.
This has been Writing Excuses. You're out of excuses. Now go write.
Would you like to help other writers be out of excuses? Review us on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. Rate us 5 stars and help someone like you find us.
Support for today's show comes from The Inner Loop Radio. If you listen to us because you're a writer, then you'll also want to listen to Rachel and Courtney talk about how to stay inspired, how to stay focused, and how to stay sane. Subscribe now to The Inner Loop Radio on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, or any other podcasting site. Get inspired, get focused, and get lit on The Inner Loop Radio.
Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. For this episode, your hosts were Mary Robinette Kowal, Dongwon Song, Aaron Roberts, and Howard Taylor. This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.